It's interesting. Another story I could have brought back. The Fukushima Prefecture license plates, like, you know, having an Illinois plate, it represents that you're from Fukushima Prefecture. So frequently when people from Fukushima Prefecture drive to other prefectures, their cars are keyed, scratched. And it really talks about this stigma. But interestingly, people from Fukushima Prefecture who've moved to other prefectures and gotten new license plates, when they come home to Fukushima to visit other relatives, their cars are keyed. So it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't. And that stigma is, it amazes me. And maybe there's a cultural issue that you could explain. But as an American, I just couldn't get over the stigma that's attached to, you know, being from Hiroshima or being from Nagasaki or being from Fukushima.
I'm thinking maybe Yuki should address that as someone from Hiroshima. Being from Hiroshima, being from Nagasaki, and then that stigma transferring over to Fukushima.
Pull up a chair.
I don't know if I'm the right person in terms of transferring the stigma to Fukushima, because I only know about Hiroshima. And when it comes to the subject, a person comes to my mind is Akiko Matsuda, mm-hmm. whom actually Norma's friend, mm-hmm. and she was saying after Fukushima, after the Fukushima accident, she was saying that we grew up. I grew up, and people, or my parents or others, were telling me that not to tell others that I had experienced the atomic bombing because of stigma. So she has never talked about her experiences. But what did she say? She told her husband after she got married?
After they were married, she said, in fact, I was there. I was bombed. And he said, me too. So they had kept it secret from each other. Yeah.
And then she said afterwards, after she showed up your class via Skype, right? And then she said, if I had talked about it, then maybe stigma might have been manifested in different way present day. So I think there are some concerns and maybe regrets among Hibakusha that they have not come out about their experiences. And as a matter of fact, my mother never told me about her experiences, but somehow I knew. So that's also a kind of family secret story.
Do you think it's because your mother worried about your being discriminated against?
Actually, the more I think about it, that's the case, because I have an older brother who is 6 years older than I am, and he seems to know more than I do. So I wondered if there is also gender issue that she wanted to protect me more. And I don't know if this is speaking of myself too much here, but they were not expecting me, when they were raising me, they were not necessarily expecting me to be married and being a housewife in the future. They were jokingly telling me that, oh, you are the second son of the Miyamoto family. And then okay. And so I grew up accordingly. So I guess, I don't know if that's just their taste, you know, their discipline or their philosophy in raising kids, like gender-free, or there might have been some concerns about it. I don't know for sure, because my mother is not with us anymore.
But what is the stigma because the people are... They're concerned that they're sick, or that their children will be sick. I mean, what's the reason behind the stigma? They survived this.
Bad genes.
What's the fear?
Is it genetic damage?
Genetic damage is a big one.
Genetic damage, but also when it comes to surviving, I don't think if you are exposed to radiation, there is no survival. What I mean by that is that you never know until you die. You literally never know when radiation catches you. So even though you are not sick, but you are sick in this case, medically diagnosed mm-hmm. illness, but then what is known among the hibakusha are they are lethargic always, they are always so tired, they are not able to work well, and so there are many symptoms which are not necessarily medically diagnosed. So, of course, employers wouldn't want to hire those people who, you know, are not reliable in term, you know, not reliable, and marriage as well. And especially earlier days in Japan, it's important for women to have sons so that the sons carry on their family names. So it's marriage is often anonymous to having kids, and especially boys. So given that cultural background, especially in the 50s and 60s, no one wants to marry to a person whose reproductive capacity is uncertain.
So you have a culture that, from a cultural point of view, recognizes the dangers of radioactivity on such a profound level of stigmatizing people. So that's part of the knowledge in the culture is that this is so dangerous, and yet the government and everything above is telling them it's all fine, and they're believing that it's fine. It's really an interesting dichotomy.
Yeah, it's a dichotomy, but they also reinforce each other because people will not want, because Fukushima residents will do everything to minimize their association with it, right? So it comes back and helps to maintain, keep the lid on things, right? It is the gift that keeps on giving, however you look at it. Now, not to rely too heavily on this weird thing called Japanese culture, I have asked a historian friend that some of us know. I said, so Bo, is there similar discrimination in American downwind communities, right? Because we have so many of them here. So, you know, Americans are so clueless about radiation, there's no discrimination. Right? So,
ignorance is bliss.
Ignorance is bliss.
I think there's another piece to the American experience in that we are a more mobile society. Mm-hmm. I was an expert on the Three Mile Island case back in the 90s. And one of the problems is that I've heard as many as 80% of the people that lived in that area left in the first 5 years. And they didn't leave forwarding addresses. So they personally recognized the danger and moved on and just kind of blended into society. One of our first videos we put up, a woman contacted me afterward, and she said, I was in 10th grade when Three Mile Island happened, and we were studying radiation as a unit in Middletown High School, which is, you can see the power plant from the high school. And I still have the email. And she said to me, we walked into class that day, and we had a Geiger counter in our window for the whole month. And it had just been click, 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 and it was a steady buzz that morning. And our teacher called the Capitol and reported it, and the Capitol said, we know, don't do anything about it. And by 11 o'clock, all of the plant workers' wives were picking their kids up and getting the hell out. So you know, it's culturally, it's different, though. When we leave and move to a different area, nobody really cares.
Was there something that
possibly happened? San Diego.
Would you repeat the question?
This could possibly happen in San Diego. Are we going to be thankful for Fukushima? How are we going to react or behave? What have we learned from it as a real life experience? What are we doing to prevent it again?
So the question is, what are we doing to prevent this again? Yes. Could it happen in San Diego or anywhere else, I suppose? Is that correct? Wants to take that
no,
one.
No, I think Arnie could. And you could, Dave.
Yeah, that's your job.
We brought you here. They can hear me anytime.
You know, I have a saying, sooner or later in any foolproof system, the fools are going to exceed the proofs. So we're definitely, it will happen again. The question is where. You know, in my career of 40 years, we've had 5 meltdowns. So that's about a meltdown every 8 years. So it will happen. Will the international response be any different? Let me tell you, during Three Mile Island, I was on the other side of the argument. I was a member of the nuclear industry. I was on television telling people, you know, don't worry, this is a non-event, we got it covered. And when Fukushima happened, I saw the same playbook being played. And I told Maggie, I said, I can't stand this. I've got to step up and you know, throw myself in front of this train. So there's an industry playbook that will minimize the amount of radiation that's released, that will minimize the cost to clean it up. And whether it's a nuclear disaster or the that oil well in the Gulf that blew, the Horizon, yeah, the playbook is the same. Minimize the immediate effects. People will forget in a week or two, and then you gradually drizzle out the negative consequences. And I don't think that playbook is going to change from what we've learned at Fukushima or Chernobyl.
I guess I do want to make two short comments in response to the question. Where Arnie left off a minute ago, I'm reminded of someone, the late Jeff Patterson, president of PSR, Physicians for Social Responsibility, referred to any communications now coming from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the nuclear industry, the governors, as secrecy, cover-up, or minimization. That's what you're going to get. And if you look at the acronym for that, it's SCUM. So I don't think that's an accident. That's the first response. The second, though, is a little geeky, and I'm reminded of Mark Twain's comment about statistics, but I think the statistic is telling because it goes to answer your question. You know, a statistic is like a captured prisoner. If you torture them enough, they'll tell you anything you want. But this one makes a lot of sense. When the nuclear industry was making its big push in the 50s and 60s and 70s, they were doing all of these mathematical models of we won't have a major accident that releases the core of the reactor for one in 10,000 reactor years. Now, a reactor year is one reactor operating 1 year. So it could be one reactor operating 10,000 years or 10,000 reactors, one, whatever, you know, the combination of that. So once every 10,000 years. We've had three in the first 3,000 years, three biggies, okay? Mm-hmm. But yesterday's symposium at the University of Chicago, two of the presenters, Christopher Crane from Exelon Corporation and an economist, that should send you warning bells and hide your wallets already, but was saying, we need nuclear power to confront the climate disruption problem. Now, most statistics I have seen say we need, the industry wants somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 more reactors in order to make some kind of a dent in dealing with the climate issue. We only have 450 operating in the world today. In the early days of the nuclear industry, the industry felt confident that it would be acceptable, and we don't know to whom, to have one major accident every 10,000 reactor years. If you build 2,000 reactors, that means they think it's perfectly acceptable for us to accept a Chernobyl or a Fukushima every 5 years. If you use the math.
Do you want to refer to the protective action guidelines too?
No, EPA's? You can't.
No, you do.
No.
Oh, well,
it's too geeky.
All right, too geeky. All right. But one thing I did want to add to your question, though, because I've spoken very harshly of the University of Chicago today, but one of the reasons I want to bring this up, and which refers indirectly to your question, is if institutions like the University of Chicago are not willing to mobilize their resources to examine what has happened so that we might actually learn from what has been happening, then things are even darker than they look.
Could you repeat that?
If institutions like the University of Chicago and others who have been engaged in the nuclear business for 75 years are not willing to examine with all that brain power and economic ability to mobilize information, to look at what our history has been and to let the rest of us know about it. I think it's a fundamental mission of institutions of higher learning. If that doesn't happen, I think our situation is even bleaker than it seems. I'm actually calling on this fine institution where I've been employed, the University of Chicago, to stand up and take the mantle so that others may follow.
We were forced into that situation. We had to produce this bomb to keep Germany from producing theirs. We had to do it in 5 years.
Which situation are you talking about?
The Manhattan Project?
Bullshit!
Wait.
No, that's not true.
Please, one at a time.
What Fermi and what happened in 43 and down in New Mexico and Nagasaki and Hiroshima, those two bombs were set off to end a war. Not start a war.
No.
Okay,
let him finish, please. Could you repeat that?
Oh, that we did not start that war, that Fermi's work and what happened in New Mexico were necessary.
What was accomplished, for lack of a better word, was necessary for survival. Because Germany would have done it.
Okay.
Am I incorrect in saying so?
Germany was incapable.
Well, that's another discussion.
That's another discussion, but I think, I mean, in response to that, there are scientists who left the Manhattan Project as soon as Germany surrendered because they said they had cooperated with the Manhattan Project to make sure that Hitler didn't get the bomb first. I'm just laying out some things for your consideration, okay?
That's where it started, right?
Yeah. I mean, okay. No, they did not want to. What is it, 71 scientists of the Manhattan Project at the University of Chicago, 69 at Oak Ridge Lael Szilard tried desperately hard to get to President Truman to keep him from dropping the bomb on a city. So at that very moment, these physicists, and I really applaud them, were very, very concerned about the impact of what they had helped to develop. Secondly, there is that. So let me just for the sake of argument, let me not even bring up, once you drop Hiroshima, did you really need to do Nagasaki? I won't even refer to all the generals, including MacArthur et al., Eisenhower, the father of carpetbagging, who all said bombing those cities was not necessary because carpet bombing did such a good job. Anyhow, let's put all that aside for the sake of argument, say that was necessary. Okay, too. But you go on to this endless experimentation, developing more bombs. At the time this University of Chicago experiment takes place on students and staff, 1961 to 63, well, I started doing some research on what common understanding was because I could imagine the counter-argument saying, standards were different back then. We didn't have informed consent, so forth and so on. Well, some standards were different, but A, the harm was well known. B, by the late 1940s, there was a consensus in the American Medical Association that you shouldn't use these technologies on subjects without a fairly strong confidence in their therapeutic benefit. It is impossible to posit a therapeutic benefit to having people ingest fallout. So I'm saying that the whole continuation of the Manhattan atomic bomb casualty, atomic energy, that whole, the afterlife, which even became a bigger than the birth itself of the Manhattan Project, I find that very hard to justify in any way. So I just want to throw that out for your consideration, accepting your argument, for what it is, saying that. Okay.
It would seem we're moving to question and discussion with the audience, which is all right. But, Yuki, you want to say something?
No, there is a young man in the back,
yes.
So I wonder if we should take his question.
Go ahead.
I just want to ask, for the sake of discussion, what do you make of the argument that mutually assured destruction as a result of nuclear weapons has brought peace?
I'm not a nuclear.
Maybe after Norma?
All I can say is I haven't, in a way I've been reluctant to look into the fine points of this argument because before we go into that, I'm thinking that to maintain the MAD regime, the mutually assured destruction regime, I'm thinking of all the human beings in the United States and elsewhere who are having to be exposed to radioactive materials in order to keep creating or maintaining these bombs. So mutually assured destruction in some mad literal way could be true in a very drawn out way.
I guess I'd like to respond in a way too.
For the next question gets asked, can you repeat the question?
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So the question had to do with mutual assured destruction, and is it viable? Is that pretty accurate?
Okay. Is it valid?
Is it valid? Okay. I guess one way I would respond to it, though, is how many times over do you have to destroy yourself to make it valid? It's been calculated, and again, the statistics are there, you know, if you like statistics. We only need 300 bombs. We got 5,000 in here. They got about 7,000 there, and a sprinkling of others through the Chinese, Indians, Pakistanis, whatever. We have something on the order of 14 institutions of higher learning, think tanks, academies devoted to the military and war and destruction. And every year the Congress fights against establishing an academy to study peace. So it would suggest to me, and when I was a kid there was a book called Growing Up Absurd, that the absurdity has continued over the last 75 years, that we're much more preoccupied in a not just pathological but almost addictive way to destruction than we are to learning about how do we get through our problems in peaceful ways. So this brings in the ethics, not just in the little box of nuclear, you know, is it ethical or not. That has to be a subset of the broader discussion of what kind of world and society do we want. And I'm really glad that we have an ethicist on our panel up here now who is going to carry that, because I have a question on this end too.
Thank you. The mutual assured destruction presupposes that the nuclear weapons protect us and attack the enemy, which I think Dr. Norma Fields' presentation clarifies that that's not the case. And I will give you a couple of examples why I also don't believe in MAD and the structure of the nuclear weapons that this protects us. For example, the U.S. alone, we have already tested 1,032 nuclear tests, and 67 are exploded on the Marshall Islands while the Marshall Islands was still the U.S. territory. And then, of course, Nevada and New Mexico and many places we have already conducted. And some of them are atmospheric, which is in the air, and others are underground and under the water. So we have already destroyed so much the environment, which also destroys us, human beings who depend upon the environment. And including all the nuclear weapons, the countries that possess nuclear weapons, we have already tested over 2,000 tests. And then talking about mutually assured destruction doesn't make sense to me. And also, several years ago, actually, six nuclear warheads flew over Chicago, over the Midwest. And that was supposed to be replaced with dummies, but then that was forgotten. So the actual warheads flew over us, six of them. And then we have lost so many nuclear weapons which have not been retrieved yet, and we have accidentally, dropped bombs, four bombs in Spain. And luckily that was not a residential area, but severely contaminated. So the decontamination is still taking place. And all given, you know, given those examples, it's hard for me to support this structure as a given. You know, that I just have a hard time in believing that MAD, this mutual assured destruction, because of this ground, the examples.
It implies rational actors, and they're not on either side.
Right. I'll go there.
I have a couple of quick questions. Number one, in 2000. Well, I heard Steve Campbell, the former Prime Minister of Canada, warn us about the purloining of nuclear fission waste products to manufacture fission bombs by terrorists. Number two, in terms of this climate change issue, what about controlled nuclear fusion as opposed to controlled nuclear fission? should we be continuing our research effort in controlled nuclear fusion as a means of developing an alternative renewable energy source to fossil fuel research?
That was a good commercial, because on tomorrow I'm going to be speaking about climate change and the nuclear alternatives versus other alternatives to climate change, and Dave will finish that out. You know, global warming or global climate change is a now problem, and to invest enormous sums of money in a program that may begin to make an impact 40 or 50 years out, at that point, that money could have been better spent on other things right now. You know, when I went to school, I graduated in 71 and then again 72, fission was nuclear fission had happened. Nuclear fusion was only 10 days away, or 10 years away, rather. And, of course, that's 40 years ago. And now it's still 20 years away. The difference, by the way, is nuclear fission is when uranium heavy atom splits. Nuclear fusion is when two light atoms are squeezed together. It's a technology whose physics is incredibly difficult. And when we get through the physics hurdles, then we have to do the engineering hurdles. But we're looking at something that's 50 years out. So if we wait and invest our time and effort on that, we'll have a climate that's uninhabitable anyway. So it's really a question of opportunity cost. Where would our money be better spent now? And I'll talk more about that next time. That was the second half of your question. There was the first half.
The first was about the prolonging of the nuclear fission waste products that former Prime Minister Kim Campbell of Canada talked about at the Chicago Public Library in 2012.
I think the issue is, you know, when you've put this nuclear waste underground for permanent storage, you effectively have a repository of nuclear bomb waste that can be tapped into in the future. There's a great movie that talks about that, Into Eternity, and you can get it on the web. And it talks about if we build a repository, do you label it knowing that language changes and 1,000 years from now no one will understand that warning sign? Or do you not label it because you know 1,000 years ago, 1,000 years from now, a Stalin or a Kim Jong-un or a Hitler will come along and want that stuff? Would it be better to just hopefully have people forget about it? But the movie that really addresses that is Into Eternity, and I think it's free on the Internet.
Yes. There are three questions. Let's see those. One in the corner, one in front. There's more now. One, two, and then there was a gentleman over here. So, Kathleen?
We talk about cleaning up sites and decommissioning sites, and I think that those words are deceptive because really we can't clean up radioactivity. We don't know how to neutralize it. We don't. What we're doing is when we clean up, right, we're moving it from someplace and then trying to stick it someplace where it doesn't access, people aren't being exposed to it. And so I'm curious about the use of the term cleaning up a site, because what it implies to people is that we can get rid of radioactive material, we can get rid of radioactive waste, when in fact, at this point, we don't know how to do it. So I'm curious, with all the resources in the nuclear science world, is anyone working on how to actually remove the radioactivity, do something with it?
We have a physicist on the panel.
You know, there's whether you're cleaning up nuclear waste or some sort of other chemical waste, you really don't clean it up. You just move it to a place, usually in an area where the people are not white and the people are poor, and stick it in the ground there as opposed to your neighborhood. So it really, that issue of cleaning up any waste is the same whether it's nuclear or not. The nuclear waste that's on a site, like Zion, will be gone in about 300 years, with the exception of the nuclear fuel, which hangs around for a quarter of a million years. So taking the contaminated dirt on the Zion site and putting it in a very dry area, a couple hundred years from now, it will be gone. But the issue of taking the waste, the spent nuclear fuel, that's a quarter of a million year problem, and that's beyond imagination. When I was at Northwestern, the quote was, the nuclear industry would have you believe that they're smart enough to store nuclear waste for a quarter of a million years, but the nuclear industry would have you believe that we're so dumb we can't store sunlight overnight. It's time to change the paradigm. But the other issue about, is there a technology to transmute radiation? You know, when they talk about, can we grow sunflowers? And yes, sunflowers suck up the radiation. Now it's in the sunflower. But what do you do with the sunflower? But if you listen to Bill Gates, he seems to think there's ways of transmuting the radiation into some other form that has a shorter half-life. And if we're going to invest all that money, why on a project that's a 50-year horizon? Again, I get to that opportunity cost issue. You know, wouldn't it be better to spend it on something that we know has turnarounds right now? You know, and I'll talk about that tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Yuki?
Not that I know about decontamination, but I have a student of mine, Nico, who is not just studying physics, but also he interned at Argonne last summer and working on decontamination, or better, transcontamination. So I wonder if you want to chime in here?
Stand up.
I actually work there right now. I do. I work for Argonne in the nuclear engineering division, and what we do right now is most of our efforts are, we work in a trio, a division where one of them's in nuclear security, another one's, you know, nuclear what's it called? Forensics, nuclear forensics, and then we have us. So we're kind of like the last portion of this, where like if something bad happens, we have a response team, and I work for immediate care cleanup. But I mean, you're definitely right. There is very few things you can do immediately to fix it. We have things that can be used to absorb the radiation and make it healthier for people to be around. It's not a fix to the problem, but it's something we're definitely working on. I have stuff that I'm working on now that's supposed to hopefully work for immediate cleanup, to where if something like this happens again, we can go in immediately and try to clean up as much as possible. The problem is the places that are already, that this has already happened to, you can't really do much about it. One of our biggest hurdles is the cleanup has to happen before the first rain. As soon as the first rain happens, we're screwed. There's nothing you can really do. It's in the rainwater. It's locked within a lot of materials. A lot of the materials I work in is soils, concretes, and like cements and urban area stuff. So it's really hard to come up with a fast solution to it. So for us to have something fast but also cost-effective, and something that can move with us, you know, as soon as something like that happens, is very difficult to come up with. And a lot of the stuff we look into is like transmuting and stuff like that, because it's far off.
Does decontamination ever prevent you from engineering, and does it prevent you from going deeper into research?
I don't understand the question, sorry.
Will the waste ever outweigh the progress?
It already does. I mean,
no, but you're in nuclear engineering. You're working with biological things. You're working with medical things. You're in biophysics.
That's an assumption.
You're working with nuclear engineering. You're in research, right?
Yeah.
You're going forward. You're going forward. You're not in the waste business. You're going forward, right?
I don't know what you mean by going forward.
That's right.
If I could just add to that one thing, is that the one thing we can do right now, and it's a problem at Zion, and it's an issue in all decommissioning, is we can get the casks right. Because we're really looking at what's called gradual, what's the what's the rest of the expression of Gordon Edwards? We can really only plan for the next 30 years. Can't plan out more than that. So we can't. If we get the casks right, we can buy ourselves 30 years. And right now, we don't have the casks right. So that's one thing we really can do right now to change the equation.
I mean, if we also talk about like stuff they're doing in Fukushima, like a lot of stuff they're doing there is going and burning the soils and burning stuff, turning it into bricks that they use in levees along the coastlines. But then how safe is that as well? So, I mean, if you're worried about, a lot of the decontamination efforts are, we have this much radiation, let's throw a mass amount of whatever we have, soil, water, whatever, into it, and then the percentage is lower.
Right.
So that's a bad solution to a problem.
We have about 15 minutes left there. We could probably do about two more questions, and then we have some announcements.
We have a couple of technical things I didn't know was next.
No, actually, this person in front is next, and then we're going to take the next person. So.
Yes. The two main speakers each referred here and there to issues pertaining to the performance of the educational institutions, in the case of U of C, and the media, specifically you referred to an AP reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a historian, not a scientist of sorts, and I wonder if you're at all familiar with lines of thinking pertaining to what's, so to speak, really going on in these sorts of institutions whereby the whistleblowers are having, if anything, on balance, an increasingly hard time over, let's say, roughly the last century, starting with Herr Hitler. And the writers in particular, John Ralston Saul, if that name means anything to you, wrote about this sort of thing back 25 years ago. And to a degree, a certain Sheldon Wolin of, if I remember right, UPenn, has written about related issues, and whereby you've got these pressures on the brasses in the educational institutions and in the media institutions, whereby they implicitly encourage their subordinates and their editors to lay in the tall grass for the most part on the sorts of things that you are doing. As far as I'm concerned, this should, okay, you know, this should be held in a stadium, not in a room of this size. But if the media, if the vast majority of the people have no idea who the hell you are and what your creds are, where are they?
Comment from a whistleblower?
The first time I was over in Japan was the Shueisha book tour. And Shueisha was so afraid that I would not get through customs that they didn't announce the book tour until I had passed over and gotten through customs. They actually had an immigration lawyer outside of customs, and I had her phone number. And if I got stuck, I was going to contact her, and they were going to try to bail me out. Within Japan, there definitely is that pressure. I met with a bunch of whistleblowers in Japan on a second trip over. There was about four or five of them. And I was telling them my experience of being screwed by the federal government. And they started to laugh, and they said, we had viewed you guys as the city on the hill. And it's so nice to hear that you screw up, too.
But you guys, so, meaning the U.S.?
The U.S., yes, yes. So the Japanese had this view of America does it perfectly. And in fact, we're no different. We were just lucky. You know, the reactors in Japan are identical to the reactors in Dresden. It's just a matter of luck. But on the issue of, I don't want to vilify the Japanese, the same thing happens in America. You know, the pressures we are under with the data that we're collecting right now is extraordinary, and I really can't get into that. But as scientists in America, well, I'll give you one example. Steve Wing, who's dead now, was a brilliant epidemiologist, and he determined that there really were lots of deaths after Three Mile Island. And immediately after he published, his research funding disappeared. So it may not be in the press, but there are all those subtle pressures that all of us
hear. No media ran with that ball, I take it.
Well, in my case, I lost my job. We were sued. We were driven into bankruptcy. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission didn't do a darn thing until John Glenn stepped in, Senator John Glenn. after the John Glenn hearings, I was out in the hall, and a famous nuclear attorney said to me, Arnie, in this business, you're either for us or against us, and you just crossed the line. So the pressure's everywhere. I don't mean to vilify the Japanese. You know, if this had happened here, we'd have the same problem. But you're right. I think you're right on why can't we make an impact to a broader group? And you just keep chipping away at it. No.
Just quickly, I think we're in an age when people, you know, we're not really living in democratic societies, right? And there really isn't free speech. And people have to become astute. And I'm thinking right away of doctors in Fukushima. They can know, I know with the 311 thyroid cancer support groups that there are doctors who help them behind the scenes. They cannot come out in open because then they won't be able to continue to see patients. So I'm hoping, I don't know many of them, but right now, there are ways to be astutely working to protect, to get the truth out. We all have to become imaginative about it and find each other. And I forgot to say on the program, there is a 311 thyroid family cancer, children's support thing. So take a look at that when you leave.
We have time for one more question. Let's go on. Well, I guess everyone's pointing at her, so whoever she is. Stand up and yell, okay, so we can hear you.
In terms of attack on this and public understanding, I found from my previous experience in dealing with old coal-fired power plants here in Illinois, as well as the toxic waste incinerators under the Illinois retail rate law that no one knew about, and yet was this huge subsidy, as we give the nuclear industry here in this state. And I find that the way I've been able to grab people in the last 20 years is talking about money. And when it comes to getting it broadcast, I wrote to Channel 11 for a year about doing a show on Chicago Tonight. They finally did it. And I said, you have a choice. We can talk about health, we can talk about politics, or we can talk about money. They wanted to talk about the money. So I got a bond trader from Chicago bond, whatever it is that they're called, the Merck or whatever. And people pay attention to money. So from that context, when they hear that the Price-Anderson Act continues to be renewed, which allows, it gives a cap to the nuclear power industry if there is an accident, that there is a limit to what they will pay and it doesn't begin to cover. The rest of it will be picked up by we taxpayers. That gets people's attention. Also, the fact that potassium iodide, which when I called David, I learned about it first maybe about 10 or 12 years ago, and that's something that Dr. Jeff Patterson used to say, it should be right next to your aspirin in your medicine cabinet. When I called Dave to find out where do I get this, I was sending it as Christmas and Hanukkah gifts to my family and friends with a little note, hope you never need this. It turns out that when I called the manufacturer, he said he was shocked that Illinois didn't have stockpiled on this what other states do. I filled a whole legal pad talking with this man because he was willing to talk. So I bought it. It was $8 a packet, and if you bought five, they threw in one free. After Fukushima, a friend called who does environmental work. She said, Mo, where did you get that stuff? And I said, gave her the name of the company. And she called me back. She said, they're out of it. You could buy it on eBay for $300 for a little packet. When it comes to things that resonate with people, I think we need to kind of change from talking about the scientific to talking about costs. The third thing that I didn't know was insurance. And I checked with my husband. He checked with our insurer on our home. Your home insurance does not cover nuclear disaster. So you will be picking up on all of the costs of this, which goes to how do we attack this to make a difference?
The panel.
I would agree. I've spoken numerous times in Vermont, and I've talked about net positive suction head and this and that and the other thing. But the moment I talked about the decommissioning fund being short and that every Vermonter would be stuck with about a $1,000 bill, I got attention. So, yeah, money talks. If you can And I think The Economist yesterday said, let's level the playing field and talk about money, except that nobody wants their subsidy to be part of the level playing field. But you're right. Money is something that a lot of people understand. And we don't have to talk about rads or rims or becquerels or any of that stuff.
Arnie, would you tell that story about walking the torch route?
And how that no, I can't.
All right. We have a few announcements, and then I'm going to turn this back over to Dr. Miyamoto for a closing. Tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, Arnie Gunderson will be doing another presentation, totally different from what you saw today, at the Third Unitarian Church, 301 North Mayfield in Chicago. It's out on the west side. So y'all come down if you like. We're going to be talking about nukes and climate change, and we do have some materials on the back table you can take with you. Second thing is, we did have a sign-in sheet, so if you didn't get your question answered at this session, please leave your email address. Email us, and we will try and get back to you as best we can over the next few weeks. We need to acknowledge some people today, though, too, and Dr. Field already started that process. Would the Himajin sisters please stand up?
Yes.
Please stand up.
Harumi.
Come. Please stand up. All right, they're just nice people. They didn't do a thing.
They're just here. They just wanted to be here.
But they are part of a project called The Atomic Age, along with Dr. Miyamoto and Dr. Field. And it's a really super website of up-to-date materials. There's some materials back there. Make sure you take them. And also resonate with the fund for the children for the thyroid, because they are sponsoring that here in Chicago. So thank you for that. Would the members of the NEIS board please stand up? Come on. I want you to acknowledge them, because without them, a program like today would not be possible. They are working hard all year long to bring quality presenters like Dr. You know, like Yuki, Dr. Never mind. These folks to forums like this, so you can get the other side of the issue and have these kinds of back and forth discussions, which you did not have yesterday. I want to acknowledge CanTV once again. This is a group that doesn't get the attention it deserves. It's the Chicago Cable Access Station in Chicago. They have been fighting for years to get a quality station together. 2 years ago, they got funding and they got it. Use them, watch them, and thank them for the service they provide to the community. Not just this, but other forums around the city. So thank you, CanTV. And finally, DePaul University and Dr. Miyamoto for setting this all up today. So thank you very much.